You are listening to the Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour, where we discuss myth, math, spirituality, philosophy, and much, much more. www.thesyncbook.com. Prost and cheers, everyone. Marty here. Welcome back for more Math Magic. Thanks for joining me as always. I'm going to jump right in here because I got a bunch of things I want to announce and speak about before we get started with the show. First off, I was a guest on David Whitehead's Truth Warrior Radio this week, and it was a live show, but you can check out the conversation that we had by going to spreaker.com/user/Truth Warrior. You can just punch in David Whitehead, Truth Warrior, and Spreaker, and it'll come up, and Spreaker's S-P-R-E-A-K-E-R. I'm going to be posting this conversation as well on my YouTube account, so look forward to that probably in the next week or so. We had an awesome talk, as we always do. We covered a bunch of ground that we had really not intended to speak on. We spoke about like the importance and mystical significance of dreams, the nature of God, the human condition. We covered a bunch of different subjects. We really didn't even touch on gematria or mathematics at all, which is kind of funny. So it was totally and completely unscripted and just kind of going with the flow. And it's just always great to speak to David. He's a noble dude. He's one of my good friends, and I really dig that show. So you can check out his radio show, Truth Warrior, Monday nights on Truth Frequency Radio. And he's always speaking with interesting guests, and his show is really, it's casual, it's conversational, and he's just a positive guy. He really wants to make change in the world, and I always have a good time over there. So check it out. And David is actually also the organizer of the Modern Knowledge Tour, and I'm happy to announce that Scott Onstott of Secrets in Plain Sight, author of Quantification and Taking Measure, will be joining the tour as well. He just confirmed this week, so I'm really excited for that. He's going to be speaking, I think at least five of the cities he's going to be speaking at. So it's going to be a killer lineup. Once again, the tour is going to include presentations and Skype call-ins from myself, of course, artists Alex and Allison Gray, Nassim Haramein from The Resonance Project, Dr. Carmen Bolter. She did the Pyramid Code documentary, which you can actually watch on Netflix. Luke Radowski of We Are Change is going to be Skype calling in. Edgar Mitchell of the Apollo 14 mission. So there's a bunch of great speakers. You can check that out at, once again, at www.modernknowledge.ca, and you can go there for all the info. And speaking of Scott Onstott, I want to give him a little plug here and a little shout out. He recently did a podcast with Michael Phillip over at Midwest Real, which was a great show. I would highly recommend subscribing to that podcast. They spoke on a whole range of topics from metrology to consciousness and awareness, the sacred numbers, of course. And, you know, I'm a big fan of both those guys, so go check it out. And our guest tonight, Randall Carlson, actually did a few shows with Michael as well, and those were great as well. So please go check that out. Like him on iTunes and all of that. Scott Onstott also did this really just killer article examining some of the measurements encoded within the Great Pyramid of Giza, and you can find that at ancient-origins.net. And I believe it's called The Mathematical Encoding in the Great Pyramid. So you can go and check that out. You can actually find it on my Facebook page. I shared that as well. So go check that out. Really great stuff. It's a short read too. So it's just check it out. I also want to say thank you to everyone who has donated to the show in the last couple weeks. It is much appreciated. Any little bit helps. And if you can, once again, help us out, even with a few bucks. I and everyone at the Sync Book, we love the listeners, we love doing what we do, and we thank you from the bottom of our hearts and for all the support, and we are going to forge ahead in the new year, and we're looking forward. We added the Sync Quick News. It's your weekly Sync Blast from Alan Abadesa Green, and all of them have been just phenomenal. They're just comical and just really interesting, make your head spin a little bit. And we also got a new show called Pentimental that's up. And there's a lot of blue sky ahead for us, so we're going to keep flying. Our web designer is actually working on spicing up the site as well. And we added a video section, a blog section that's going up. There's a contributor section. And so it's coming along nicely. And so there's so much for you to check out. If you get the chance, go there, you know, absorb all the great material, let it roll around in your noggin for a while, and, you know, rinse and repeat. To let everyone know, I'm not sure if there's going to be a podcast going out for the week of Christmas, I should say, and possibly the week after. I'm not really sure yet. I'm flying home for the holidays, and I'm going to be tied up with visiting family and friends and whatnot. So it's just a little forewarning about that. I'm working right now on doing a Christmas special podcast. It's just going to be me speaking about, you know, the true meaning of Christmas and, you know, just about the holiday, the astronomical cycles and things like that. And it's sort of a 1 hour lecture, but due to time constraints, I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to get it done, but I'm working hard. I'm going to keep working and I'm going to keep my fingers crossed. So possibly look forward to that. And that leads us to our show tonight. I got to speak with Randall Carlson over at Sacred Geometry International. And I want to give a shout out to Cameron Wiltshire over there, who runs the website and handles all the social media. I want to say thank you to him for setting this up. He's a good dude and he works hard. And I just can't say enough good things about Sacred Geometry International. Tons of great articles. They have online geometry classes. It's, I think, levels 1 through 3. I've taken all of them and I'm going to go through them again. And so you can go purchase those there. It's just a wonderful way to help you enter the world of sacred geometry. And honestly, I'm not really that adept at the actual drawing aspect of sacred geometry, the hands-on work with the compass and square and whatnot. Most of the stuff I learned was through CAD programs, and my focus was more on arithmomancy, gematria, number symbolism, that sort of thing, the qualitative aspects of numbers. And so Randall's classes there, they're a great way to get back to the basics and really learn this stuff from the ground floor. So go check that out. They also have a DVD for sale called Cosmic Patterns and Cycles of Catastrophe. I think it's, I'm not sure how many hours it is. I want to say like 4 hours or something like that, but I've watched it probably 3 or 4 times now. And there's just a ton of great nuggets of info. And I really feel that this, this body of knowledge needs to be resurrected. It is extremely important. And so I absolutely support the work that Randall does over there. And we speak about this in the podcast, but they also have a few webinars coming up in January. And I'll be attending one of them anyway. And they are called The Quest for the Cosmic Grail, Recovering the Lost History of the World. There's 2 sessions, Sunday, January 4th, and Sunday, January 11th, 2015, of course. If you're in New York, East Coast time, 2 p.m. to 4 p.m., West Coast, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Once again, Sundays, January 4th and 11th. Go check those out. I believe they are about $55 each. And this would be a great Christmas present for anyone who is into sacred geometry or who is a seeker and is interested in starting to learn this stuff. Randall puts on one hell of a presentation, and there's going to be, of course, like images and graphics and the like. So instead of buying that material good for your family member or loved one, you know, friend, whatever, how about getting them a ticket for this webinar? You know, instead of going to the big corporate chain stores or the mall or whatever and blowing your hard-earned money on some junk or garbage, how about giving the gift of knowledge this year, all right? So go there, check it out. Once again, that's Sacred Geometry International. And you can also follow them on Facebook and Twitter. I post stuff there occasionally, and I know there's a bunch of different people that post stuff there. Cameron's always working on that. So, and I believe in the coming year or so, I will probably do a webinar through the site and possibly do it, possibly contributing some articles as well. And I know they're looking at getting together a sacred geometry conference in Atlanta at some point, though this is all preliminary stages. It's all in the works. So if and when that does happen, you will hear it here first, and hopefully that'll come to fruition. Looking forward to that. So, all right, that is enough of my ranting and raving. Let's fucking do this. Our guests tonight are from Sacred Geometry International, Randall Carlson, and the musical guest is Portland, Oregon's The Harmed Brothers. This show is brought to you by the SyncBook Radio. Check out all the wonderful podcasts. 42 Minutes, Always Record, Astro Music, Pentimental, and Synchronize. More information about SyncBook Press, SyncBook Radio, and SyncBook events can be found at www.thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please share it with your friends and please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website, and please consider setting up a monthly charge as it helps us keep the lights on and helps keep our microphones humming. And as always, thank you for your support.
Out of all the guys out there, I know you're going to say Robert, you know, Vival and Shock. But out of all the guys out there, who's the guy that you really think we should be made aware of that maybe we don't know about?
I think you should be made aware about the work of Randall Carlson, RANDALLCARLSON. His website is sacredgeometryinternational.com. Randall Carlson is one of the great unsung geniuses who is revealing to us the truth about our past. And it's been my privilege to spend the last 10 days traveling across the cataclysm fields of the northwest of America, looking through his eyes at the effects of this terrible cometary disaster.
The clip you just heard was from Graham Hancock, speaking of the paradigm-changing work of Randall Carlson. As you just heard, Randall and Graham recently underwent a 10-day excursion through the Pacific Northwest, much of which will be covered in Graham's next book, the follow-up to his best-selling Fingerprints of the Gods. Randall Carlson is a master builder, an architectural designer, a teacher, geometrician, geomythologist, geological explorer, and renegade scholar. He has 4 decades of study, research, and exploration into the interface between ancient mysteries and modern science. He has been an active Freemason for over 30 years and is a past master of one of the oldest and largest Masonic lodges in Georgia. He has been recognized by the National Science Teachers Association for his commitment to science education for young people, and his work incorporates ancient mythology, astronomy, earth science, paleontology, symbolism, sacred geometry, metrology, architecture, geomancy, and other arcane and scientific traditions. For over 25 years, he has presented classes, lectures, and multimedia programs synthesizing this information for students of the mysteries. It is his aspiration to effect a revival of lost knowledge towards the goal of creating the new world based upon universal principles of harmony, freedom, and spiritual evolution. So without further ado, let's get pious with Randall Carlson. Randall, thanks so much for taking the time to sit down and speak with me. I've been really anxious for this show for quite some time, ever since Cameron and I have chatted about having you on. So thanks so much for taking the time.
Well, hey, thanks for having me.
So maybe can we get some history here before we get started? Like, how did you get going down this path of exploration of ancient metrology and architecture and sacred geometry and the like?
Well, it was pretty straightforward. My father was a builder, and he designed and built a couple of hundred houses growing up. So I started helping him, you know, in my, at about the age of 12. And in the early 70s, I was belonged to a meditation group, and we decided to build a couple of geodesic domes up in the North Woods of Minnesota for our retreats and so forth. So because of the fact that I was one of the few people in the organization that had much construction experience, I got drafted into being a sort of a lead carpenter for building some of these domes. And so I got, that led me into being very interested in Buckminster Fuller's work. Mm-hmm. And one of the domes was kind of an amalgamation of Buckminster Fuller's geodesy, or his geodesic domes, and Islamic geometry. One of the members of the organization was an architect, and he came up with this interesting design. And so that was pretty much my first exposure to working with the idea that, you know, geometry really seems to be integral to this whole building process. And then the dome that was this fusion of Buckminster Fuller's geometry and Islamic geometry was featured in a national publication called Shelter, which I think came out in 1973. And it was a large format paperback kind of a publication that delved into all kinds of vernacular architecture and experimental architecture. And they devoted a whole page to this one particular dome that I had been working on. But they also covered a lot of other things. They delved into some of the work of Le Corbusier, who used a system called the modular, you might be familiar with that, which he based upon the golden section. And that was 1973, summer of 1973 that came out. And that was my first real exposure to this whole idea of the golden section, which really intrigued me. And then there was a lot of discussion about architecture and geometry and proportion in there. And I just found it compellingly fascinating. And so I began to explore into it at about that time. And I can pretty much pinpoint it to the summer of 1973. Now, at that time, there wasn't a whole lot available, but I began to, you know, scour our libraries and so forth, looking for anything that I could find. And then as the 70s progressed on, there was some things that did come out that I accessed, the work of John Michel, who I'm sure you're familiar with.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was his work, you know, the View Over Atlantis and City of Revelation, which View Over Atlantis came out in 69. I did not discover that, I think, until about 1974. And then shortly thereafter, City of Revelation. And I was really just struck by some of the amazing coincidences between number and language and architecture that he got into there, and astronomy and so on. And then I discovered the work of Keith Critchlow, who had actually been a student of Buckminster Fuller and had done some of the early work on sacred geometry that came out in the 70s. And as the 70s progressed, I, you know, looked for pretty much anything that I could find on the subject. I came across the work of George Lesser, who was a geometrician and author who basically looked at the geometry of the cathedrals, the Gothic cathedrals. And he did a two-volume set called, I think it was just called Sacred Geometry. And it actually came out, I think, in the early 50s, but it had gone out of print. And just by sheer luck, I stumbled upon the two-volume set being sold at a library sale. This was probably 76 or 77. So I got that, and it had lots of really nice color fold-out diagrams and things like that that, you know, showed the ground plans of the cathedrals and churches and how there were two systems of proportioning that were predominantly used in there. And this is where I first learned about the ad quadratum and the ad triangulum that he discussed, that the ad quadratum was based upon the square and the proportions of a square, which essentially is the square root of 2 to 1, as you know, because the diagonal of a square is square root of 2 times whatever the side length of the square is. Sure. And the ad triangulum, which was based upon the geometry of the equilateral triangle, which is, you know, basically the square root of 3. You know, when you take the two equilateral triangles, as you know, and put them base to base, you're going to have the proportions of the vesicapiscus, which is the square root of 3 to 1. So I learned about that there, and I began to try to think, how can I apply this to some of the stuff that I'm doing in my small scale of, because by this time I had my own business, and I was doing small scale contracting work and doing, you know, drawing most of the plans and stuff for the projects that I was doing. And so I started trying to come up with ways that I could incorporate this into my building work and design work. And then it came, I would guess, let's see, by the late 70s, I had pretty much, you know, I think it was like 79, I did my first ever workshop on sacred geometry. And then that kind of spawned a regular weekly class that I did, leading into the early 80s. And then I kind of got sidetracked during the early 80s because my younger brother showed up and we really took our business to the next level. And I went from being like a 1 or 2 or 3 man operation into having 15 and 20 employees in the company. And so my sacred geometry studies kind of fell by the wayside for a few years. Then as the 80s progressed, you know, I began to do more traveling in the later 80s. I traveled around Europe and actually began to visit the Gothic cathedrals and other sites, megalithic sites and so on, and studying how geometry was used, you know, in the cathedrals, in the ancient megalithic structures. I should also mention, I guess, let's see, in 1978, I joined the craft of Freemasonry because in my studies up to that point, I kept encountering the Freemasons. And as I learned more about the geometry that was incorporated into the Gothic cathedrals, you know, constantly there were references to the Freemasons. Mm-hmm. Then I came across a two-volume set by Hans Bruns, who was a, I think he was Finnish. He was a Finnish architect and Freemason who wrote a book called, you may be familiar with it, The Secrets of Ancient Geometry and Its Use. Have you ever seen that?
No, I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, okay. It's probably out of print again. It was a two-volume set, and I remembered it got translated into English in the late 70s. And I remember it was really expensive, and I ordered the set, and it came from Europe, I believe. And so I was studying that, and then that, just coincidentally, I happened to meet somebody at about that time who was a Freemason, and we had extensive discussions about this and geometry, and it was at that point that I really began to understand how geometry was the key and the basis to the whole Masonic allegory and symbolism. Mm-hmm. So I decided, well, you know, I think I'm going to just petition to craft and join up and see what I learn. And so I did. That was 1978. And I've been an active Freemason ever since. And I would definitely say that that was a pivotal event because it opened up to me a whole body of interesting symbolism and information that I probably would have never had access to otherwise. Plus, here in Atlanta, there's a really awesome Masonic library that I had access to. So I was, are you there?
I am. Yeah.
Okay, good. So then I began studying it from the angle of Freemasonry and realized, you know, that I learned in Freemasonry, in fact, you even taught this, that geometry is the key to the whole system.
Sure.
So, you know, it kind of went from there. I left out a lot, obviously, but, where it began, I guess, in the early 70s, you know, I came out of this, you know, I was part of the late 60s and all of the things that, you know, happened and came down in the late 60s. And there were certainly some pivotal events there where I, you know, essentially saw what I described as the hidden architecture of the universe or creation or consciousness, however you want to describe it. And that sort of prepared me, psychologically and intellectually to get into the study of sacred geometry.
Before we get, because I'd actually like to come back around and discuss a little bit more of your involvement with Freemasonry, things like that, and how influential that's been. But before we get there, actually, apropos to a few things that you were saying earlier, one thing that I noticed that the square root of 2 plus the square root of 3 is actually like 3.146. which I thought was really interesting. So,
isn't that wild?
Yeah. Obviously, not a coincidence there. So, but before let's lay some foundation here first, because a lot of people probably don't even know, like, what is sacred geometry? What is the deal with this? Why is this geometry considered sacred? I know you just mentioned that this is sort of like the hidden architecture of reality, but maybe you can kind of flesh this out a little bit.
Yeah, well, certainly I think from what I've seen of your work, you are definitely aware of the fact that there does seem to be this geometric matrix underlying all things. That's pretty much what you learn in Freemasonry if you penetrate into the symbolism of it. But clearly, I think that's the idea, is that there is, you know, geometry pervades all of creation. And, you know, we find that when we look in various spiritual traditions, whether East or West, we find that geometry is an integral part of the teachings, and often I think provides the key to understanding the inner teachings, the esoterica of a variety of spiritual traditions. Certainly, you know, it was Kepler who said, you know, and Galileo who said that, you know, mathematics is the alphabet with which God has written the universe. And, you know, St. Augustine, you know, had numerous writings about the importance of geometry and mathematics to understanding the sacred teachings. And so there, I think the idea is that underlying or pervading all of creation is geometry. That's certainly what Freemasons teach. And,
Yeah, Kepler even said, where there is matter, there is geometry. So
where there is matter, yeah, that's a good one. Where there is matter, there is geometry, yes. So I think the idea here is that no matter where you look, you see that there's geometry. Let's see, I have the quote right in front of me. St. Augustine said, numbers are the thoughts of God.
Yeah.
You know, Kepler said, one of his quotes was, geometry existed before the creation. It is co-eternal with the mind of God. Geometry provided God with a model for the creation. And that pretty much, to me, sums up what it's all about, is that there is this underlying order. And the key to deciphering and perceiving this underlying order is geometry. And I also think geometry is, you know, integral to our own consciousness. And by the study of geometry, we develop our mind in certain ways. I think this is why Plato put so much emphasis on learning geometry as the foundation for metaphysical studies. I think that, again, the idea, I think, is that all of creation is pervaded by geometry. There is an architecture of creation. I think of sacred geometry as the hidden architecture of creation. It's not really hidden because it's everywhere around us. It's just a matter of training yourself to be able to perceive it.
Yeah, exactly. And this is something that I've noticed. At least I've noticed with my own life. I've noticed by speaking, you know, guys like you and looking at your work, looking at guys like Scott Onstott's work, that people that seem to go into this training, it allows their consciousness to bloom. It allows their intelligence to really unfold. And that this is what you're alluding to here, not even alluding to, you're addressing directly, is that a lot of these ancient people, when they got to the study of geometry, it allowed them to really kind of help them understand the world, if you will. And that seems to be what the key point is in sacred geometry. At least that's what I found.
Yeah, and I totally concur with that. I think that's really hits the nail on the head. The Bible, of course, is filled with mathematics and geometry, as you're well aware.
Sure.
And many of the, you know, I talk to, you know, Christian acquaintances and so forth, and I try to tell them, you know, this is not just a matter of, you know, emotional faith in dogmas. There's also a hidden teaching in there that is consistent with, you know, esoteric teachings you find from all over the world, from many traditions, whether it's, you know, the Vedic tradition or even esoteric traditions from the Western Hemisphere. You know, the Mayan cosmology is full of geometry and cycles and mathematical relationships. And, you know, I try to point out that, you know, Christianity has as its basis also this recognition of the importance of geometry and number.
This is what you're making such a good point, because this is what to me is so beautiful about this. And, you know, maybe get your take on this, is that this is when we look at it through the eyes of sacred geometry, this is a unifying force. It's not a force of division, where a lot of especially the organized religions, it creates this division, like, okay, well, you know, I'm an Islamic or I'm Christian, so that means I'm different than you. But when we look at it through geometry, this is what brings the whole thing together. To me, that's really beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, I think you've just, again, you've really hit it there. It is a unifying force. It shows us that underneath the dogmas and the outerlying expression of these organized religions, there is a common thread. And one of those, of course, is mathematics and geometry. And I try to really show people that, you know, there is this underlying unity. And I think what you just said, I think it's very important that people grasp that idea, that there is this underlying unity. And it's also very compatible with reason and, you know, rational thinking. It's not just a matter of accepting some dogma on faith because somebody else tells you to believe it. Mm-hmm. You know, it gives the individual the ability to test things for themselves. You know, there's, to me, because once you begin to become aware of this matrix, if you will, of mathematics and geometry underlying everything, whether you were talking about the molecular level or the galactic level and or anything in between, you know, once we begin to recognize that there is this underlying matrix of number and mathematics and geometry that transcends all the sectarian differences, we may have a basis for kind of coming to some kind of, you know, reconciliation between these opposing viewpoints, because the opposition only seems to occur, you know, in the outer spheres of these traditions. But when you penetrate to the inner sphere of it, to the inner core, you find that there is an essential unity.
I'm actually dating this girl right now. She's a Persian, and we were looking up the Arabic gematria for the Quran last night, and one of the first verses in the Quran is basically this idea of God unveiling itself to the world. And so she put the numbers to the letters of this first verse, and it equaled 111. And then I looked at and God said, "Let there be light," which is of course God unveiling itself to the world in Genesis, and using this particular cipher, and it equaled 111 as well. So here we have Islam here, and Christianity, or the Judeo-Christian canon, we should say, harmonizing beautifully with the power of number. And I just thought that just kind of what you were saying, I thought was just really beautiful. So
it is.
Yeah, it takes those divisions and just kind of wipes them clean. So you just mentioned reason, and maybe we can focus on some of these. Re is the Egyptian sun god in the Book of the Dead. Ra is of course Ra. Sun is phonetic to the sun, of course. So we look at the word reason, we really are dealing with a focus on our central source of the sun. And one of these key numbers is 864. Maybe we can go into some of these numbers, these important numbers that we find in the pantheon of sacred geometry, and the symbolism and importance behind some of these numbers. Can we maybe hit on a few here? 108, 864, 528, maybe some of those. Maybe sure. Start with 864.
Well, okay, let's do that. But before we do, let's go back to the number you just mentioned, 111. In Kabbalistic work, the intelligence of the sun is Nakiel, which is spelled Nun, Kaf, Yud, Aleph, Lamed. So if you add those up, you get 111. And then that becomes the basis for this whole set of Trinitarian numbers. It is 222, 333, 444, 555, and of course the famous 666, but there's also 777, 888, 999. They're all multiples of 37, which is sort of like the seed number for this particular series. Let's see, of course, you said the number 864, which is the number of one of the spellings in Hebrew, or rather in Greek, of Jerusalem is 864. Sure. Because according to John Michel and several other commentators, Jerusalem was sort of to the whole complex of Judaism as the sun was to the solar system, and which would make that symbolism be particularly appropriate. But half of 864 is 432. So if you had, for example, a circle with a radius of 432, its diameter would be 864. And 432 has a lot of interesting correlations. Kabbalistic correlations, numerical correlations. That particular number serves as the basis not only for the Sumerian king lists, but the Vedic yugas. Mm-hmm. It's also the scaling ratio that links the Great Pyramid to the size of the earth. You probably know that the Sumerian king lists basically use the number 432,000 as the reign, the longest reign. I think it was Xisuthrus, and then 432,000 becomes the basis for the Vedic system of the yugas, where the Kali Yuga is 432,000, and then the Dwapara Yuga is double that, or 864,000. Mm-hmm. And then the Treta Yuga is triple that basic number, which is 1,296,000. And then the Satya Yuga is the four times that, which is 1,728,000. So these numbers are all in a sequence, and there's many correlations between them. I think we find them, like I just said, the Vedas are pervaded with these numbers. Apparently they were important enough to the Egyptians that they were scaling. I don't know if you've seen this work. I think I presented some of that in the cosmic patterns. I think I went into pretty great depth on the geodetic connection between the pyramid and the earth, and how the pyramid scales the northern hemisphere of the earth on by a scaling ratio of 43,200 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. And, so yeah, these numbers are found, pervading all of these various systems.
maybe we can hit on something here, because one thing that I've had with the people have questioned, you know, when I presented this stuff, is the idea of like, okay, well, you're linking the number 432 to 4,320 to 43,200. And basically there's this idea in that's kind of quintessential to sacred geometry, that there's a scale invariance, that the number itself is almost like the word, and that this transcends scale. Can we kind of discuss that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that, you know, the idea, one of the critical concepts of this whole study is scale invariance, that, you know, and geometry demonstrates scale invariance. You know, when we look at the system of dynamic symmetry as developed by Jay Hambidge back in the early 20th century, where he showed that, you know, using these particular numbers like square root of 2, square root of 3, square root of 5, and so on, you can create a pattern where all of the parts relate to the whole by a consistent geometric proportion. And so this was the basic idea, Greek idea of harmony, was that you had a relationship between the whole of a composition and its part, and that could be expressed by a fairly simple mathematical relationship. So the square root of 2 can be used to create a rectangle where the length of that rectangle is to its width as the square root of 2 to 1. And it's easy to create geometrically, because as soon as you've produced a square and drawing its diagonal, you've created that root 2 relationship. And then from there, it's easy to generate a rectangle whose length to width ratio is expressed by the square root of 2. Well, if you divide that down the middle on the long axis, then the two sub-rectangles that you have created also have the same proportions as the original rectangle. If those are again cut in half, you again have a rectangle with the same proportions. If you double it along the short axis, you then end up with a rectangle that's double the size of the original, but the ratio of length to width remains constant. And that is the idea. I think one of the key ideas of scale invariance is that you can reproduce to infinity one of these patterns, either diminishing or expanding, without losing the constant of proportionality. The same thing holds with the root 3 rectangle, which is basically where the long side is to the short side in the ratio of the square root of 3 to 1, which is in round numbers 1.732 to 1. And that's, again, very easy to generate geometrically simply by drawing the vesica, which is created by drawing two circles of equal radius such that the center of one falls on the circumference of the other. And then in that overlap of the two, that looks very much like a Venn diagram in math, the length of that overlap to its width is the square root of 3 to 1. And it's quite easy to draw. I'm sure you're familiar with how to create a vesica with, you know, basically two turns of the compass. Draw one circle, just set the point of the compass on the circumference, anywhere on the circumference of the first circle, draw a second circle of the same radius, and in that overlap, you've created the square root of 3 to 1 relationship. And then that could be used to generate rectangles and patterns and so forth, where again, the part recapitulates the pattern of the whole, so that there's this constant of proportionality throughout it. And you can subdivide the original into as many components as you want, and they're all going to carry that same geometric ratio. Or you can go in the other direction. And so the square root of 2 and the square root of 3 were two of the fundamental ratios that were used to create this particular kind of scale invariant harmony. And they were the basis for the Masonic systems of ad quadratum and ad triangulum that were used in medieval architecture, but actually can be found in all kinds of architecture throughout the world, but really kind of reached their apotheosis during the Middle Ages in the building of the Gothic cathedrals.
Mm-hmm. So, which is something interesting that somebody has brought up to me, that's like, that basically when you look at that, what you're kind of not even kind of, what you're really looking at is fractals. Because and in a very, very simple geometric way. So people was like, oh, fractals is a modern day theory. It's like, no, actually, if you just do simple geometry, you're going to see that right away. And that, and that's what's so beautiful. So it's like you can easily see that people of the past with just a little bit of philosophy and some basic geometry can understand this sort of fracticality or whatever, if you will, of the universe. That is such a strong philosophical idea that it doesn't matter how many times the universe divides or multiplies, you're going to have the same ratios play out again and again and again.
Yes.
Yeah, that's just a strong point. One of the things that I've come to, and I know you know you've talked about this as well, discussed this, is the concept of number, mathematics, geometry being the language of creation itself. Of course, we, you know, you just mentioned Galileo's quote, Kepler, that sort of thing. But this kind of directs us to this ever elusive concept of the confusion of tongues or the Tower of Babel. And the confounding of speech. And one of the things that's drawn me to is that the speech that they're talking about, the thing that everybody shared was this speech, this language of mathematics. Is that, can you talk a little bit about this? Because this is such a strong point to me to help us understand these myths, especially the biblical myths, a lot more.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I've been basically saying for years, is that I would say that, yeah, and I think even a lot of more conventional thinkers in the realm of mathematics would concur with this idea that geometry does provide us with a type of universal language. Because those relationships, the ones, for example, that I was just talking about, it doesn't matter what your ethnicity is, what your language is, what your religion is, they are universal. You know, the relationship of a diagonal of a square to its side is what it is no matter what, no matter what your belief system.
Yeah. It's not like there's a Mayan square and a Hindu square or, you know, Christian. There's right. Just a square, right?
Right, exactly. So it definitely, I could see the argument and concur with that argument that the geometry would provide a type of universal language. You know, whether that literally was meant, I'm not sure, but I would certainly think that of all the possible interpretations, that would be one that would be most likely, that we could be looking at, you know, the idea of mathematics and geometry underlying all of the diverse outer languages that people speak. Now, on the other hand, I mean, if you look at linguistics, I do think that there's some interesting evidence showing that many of the modern day languages all are, you know, branches off of some fundamental trunk of languages that goes way back into prehistory. But again, you know, I think that Kabbalah teaches us that there is this intimate connection between number and language, that's one of the, to me, one of the great mysteries, one of the great, you know, mystical mysteries, if you will, of many of these teachings, is this relationship between language and number, or language and geometry. And I don't know if you have, you know, certainly John Michel got into a lot of that in his work. Showing the Kabbalistic values of various words and how they relate to many of these numbers that are found in the sacred canon. But, you know, so many of these numbers are embedded just in the you know, the our everyday usage. You mentioned the number 864. Well, you know that in a typical solar day, there's 24 hours, right? Mm-hmm. So everybody knows that, but most people don't stop to actually think, well, those 24 hours times 60 minutes means there's 1,440 minutes in a day. And given that, you know, each minute is 60 seconds, 1,440 times 60 is 86,400 seconds in a solar day. And so then 12 hours, or one half, you know, one round of the clock is going to be half of that, or 720 minutes, or 43,200 seconds, which is an interesting correlation, because 43,200, as I mentioned, to a high degree of accuracy, is the scaling ratio between the Great Pyramid and the Northern Hemisphere. In other words, take the square perimeter of the pyramid's base, circle the square, and then enlarge that by a factor of 43,200, and you've basically got the equatorial radius of the, or equatorial circumference of the Earth. Mm-hmm. And if you take the height of the pyramid, not the height of the actual pyramid as it now is truncated, but of the idealized pyramid, using that 51.85 angle of the casing stones, and project them up to the apex, and use that as a height. Now you take that times 43,200, and you've got the polar radius of the Earth. Now, you know, the skeptic could argue, well, you're just playing with numbers. Well, yes, we are playing with numbers, but I think perhaps what we're getting to here is that, you know, God played with numbers to create the universe. And these numbers are intrinsic to everything. They're intrinsic to our bodies. They're intrinsic to, you know, molecular and atomic processes. We find them intrinsic to much larger in fact, the largest scale that we can perceive the universe operating on, we find numbers pervading, and they appear to be many of the same numbers. You know, they're embedded in the solar system, clearly. Mm-hmm. You know, again, 864,000. If we don't count the asthenosphere, or rather the chromosphere of the sun, you know, it's very close to 864,000 miles in diameter. Mm-hmm. And then that being the, you know, like the Greek spelling of Jerusalem, and then the symbolism of Jerusalem as the solar capital. You know, it goes on.
I know Teotihuacan, which is the pyramid of the sun. They have a pyramid of the sun, pyramid of moon. They actually have standard Teotihuacan units, and they base that pyramid off 864 units, which I think is just really. And I know in this particular cipher that, you know, I've gotten from the, you know, the Freemasonic symbolism and that sort of thing, Jesus equals 27 and Christ equals 32, and Jesus times Christ actually equals 864 as well. So yet a number coming up, you know, within the name of Jesus, which is just fascinating to me.
Yeah, totally. So yeah, the pre-deluge God kings of Samaria. There were 10 of them, and the total number of years in the reigns, the symbolic reigns of these 10 kings was 432,000 years. And also, if you look at the numbers of the individual reigns, you discover that they are all these sacred numbers: 36,000, 64,800, 28,800, 10,800. You know, in the Mayan world ages, a baktun is equal to 144,000 days. In the Vedic ages, you know, the Kali Yuga, like I said, was 432,000 years. It's almost as if, you know, the Sumerians are preserving one level of scale invariance where they're talking about these reigns of the Sumerian kings that total out to 432,000 years. Then the Vedas take it from 432,000 and, you know, carry it up through the four yugas, the Kali, Dwapara, Treta, Satya, as I was talking about. And then if you add them all together, you get 4,320,000 years, which is 10 times the basic unit, which is 432,000. So it's interesting that there's almost like a graded series or sequence between the Sumerian and the Vedic traditions. The Sumerian king lists carry the numbers up to 432,000, and then the Vedas take it from 432,000 up to 4,320,000. But again, we discovered that the same numbers, the Treta Yuga, its duration in, you know, each of the yugas was broken into three parts. You had the Sandhya, which was the transition into the yuga, and then you had the Sanghyamsa, which was the transition out of the yuga. So, for example, the Treta Yuga, the Sandhya was 108,000 years, the Sanghyamsa was 108,000. And the length of the actual trade itself was 1,080,000. But then when you added those three numbers up, you got 1,296,000, as I would say, human years. So they have a way of encoding these numbers. In the Satya Yuga, which was in divine years, 4,000 divine years, was in its human years was 1,440,000. So there's that 144 again.
Sure.
And Sandhya leading into it was 144,000. The Sandhyamsa leading out of it was 144,000. So we find these same numbers showing up in these diverse traditions. And I don't think that one's justified in just dismissing with a wave of the hand that this is all just playing with numbers and has no meaning. Because at some point, this coincidental correlation of these numbers and these patterns has to assume some kind of function or some kind of a meaning. And, you know, there is that mindset out there that basically that reductionist mindset that basically wants to avoid the implications of these this universality of this tradition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to go back to 108 because there was something I want to cover. But first, I want, you know, something going back to what we were kind of talking about of the idea that this is sort of a language. What I think people have to realize is that by encoding those numbers, whether they meant this literally or not by these ancient traditions, whether this is the Vedas or whatnot, by encoding those numbers, they're actually passing on information through the number itself. And the thing that I think people need to realize is that if I said, and I forget who I was talking to, maybe like Scott or Vinny Eastwood or something like that, but if I said to you 2,160, and that's all I said, you could probably talk to me for the next half hour on the number 2,160, and that's all I would have to say. And so there's a direct communication that's happening within the symbolism and the attributes of the number themselves, which I, you know, in getting into this study, you start to see that again and again and again. And this is the kind of the idea of the blooming of the consciousness, if you will. So I just kind of wanted to mention that. So,
and you said the number 2,160, which I find interesting because that's basically 1/12 of the processional cycle.
Yeah, sure.
As you're aware of. And so then that leads us into the whole other dimension of this study, which, you know, I've tried to, you know, been part of the thing that I've been teaching is that when we start talking about sacred geometry, you know, most people, you say geometry, they start thinking patterns, diagrams, they start thinking of relationships in space. But I also like to emphasize that we're talking about relationships in time as well. And, you know, which would be meaningless from the model of our contemporary models of linear time. But when we start talking about cyclical time, which is much more in line with ancient concepts, now these numbers start showing up. You know, the modern estimate of the rate of precession of the equinoxes is just slightly in excess of 50 arc seconds per year. Well, in round numbers, that works out to be 25,920 years for a full cycle, give or take a few centuries. Well, since we don't know necessarily that the precessional rate is constant throughout the whole cycle, or that each cycle is going to be, you know, absolutely exactly hitting on that number, maybe sometimes it's a little more, sometimes a little less, we don't know. But it's certainly realistic enough to talk about in round numbers using this traditional number of 25,920 as the length of the precessional cycle. Well, that means that as that vernal equinox is moving through the 12 signs of the zodiac, if you divide those 12 signs of the zodiac into 12 equal pie slices, it basically spends 2,160 years in each of those sectors of the circle. And each of the sectors of the circle, of course, then carries the name of the constellation that is found centered within that sector. But, you know, so that, for example, you know, for the last roughly 2,160 years, the vernal equinox has been transiting through the constellation of Pisces. And before that, it was transiting through the constellation of Aries. Now, if you go out and actually look at the sky, you'll see that the angular displacement of the constellation of Aries is much, much smaller than that of Pisces. Pisces, as a star cluster, is much more spread out. But the idea here is that in this idealized wheel of the zodiac, the circle of this, the full cycle, is divided into 12 equal slices. And so it's 2,160 years for each of those. And then, of course, you double that and you have 43,000 or 4,320. And so if you take four ages of this precessional cycle, for example, if we counted back from through the age of Pisces, back through the age of Aries, back through the age of Taurus, and back through the age of Gemini, we're standing on the cusp of Cancer Gemini, and we're at 8,640 years ago. So there's that number again. So they show up in this great wheel of time as well, which I find to be very, very interesting because we find the same set, the same canon of cosmological numbers linking time and space.
I just had Walter Cruttenden on the last show, actually, and he wrote the book Lost Star of Myth and Time, and he works for the Binary Research Institute, and they're looking at all of these, this great span of time is precession, the equinoxes and things like that. And one of the questions I asked him, and I'll ask this to you, is like, this is such a great span of time. We're, you know, roughly between 24,000, 26,000 years. We really don't know. Roughly, you know, approximated at 25,920. Why do you think it was so important for these ancient people to map this great span of time, considering, you know, you can't even notice it in your own lifetime, essentially. Why do you think that's so important?
Well, for me, I think that the most significant importance of it is that it's like the clock that shows us the timing of these, what I refer to as the nonlinear episodes in Earth history. And what's quite coincidental right now, perhaps, maybe not coincidental, I'll use the term, is that, you know, you've probably heard, well, some of the research that Graham Hancock is doing right now, he's been looking at this, what's called the Balling-Alarod Younger Dryas climate oscillation. And, you know, this has been identified, you know, decades ago, but for years, paleoclimatologists and geologists and scientific people who have been looking at that particular era, glaciologists, for example, have pinpointed this really abrupt transition to somewhere around 13,000 years ago. Well, you know, in 2007, Richard Firestone and his colleagues published their evidence that there was actually at this Balling-Alarod Younger Dryas boundary the signature of some kind of a cosmic event that showed up in the form of microspherals and magnetic grains and buckyfullerenes and potential spike of platinum group metals. And they've been dating that. And curiously, the dating comes right up at 12,960 years, you know, give or take a few decades. Which what's interesting to me was that, you know, I had come upon this whole notion of catastrophism, you know, decades ago, and literally in the 80s, had concluded that, yes, there really are catastrophes in Earth history, and that there's probably some kind of a tempo to them, that they're not necessarily random. And then through my studies of, you know, the ancient number systems and the patterns and so forth, I concluded that one of the last great episodes of concentrated global change would have occurred on the cusp of Virgo Leo, which was 12,960 years ago. I actually gave a series of lectures in the early 90s where I pinpointed that date. I have, you know, recordings of lectures I gave up at Warren Wilson College in 1996 where I'm talking about the date of 12,960 years, give or take a century or two, as being a period at which something very profound happened that changed the trajectory of Earth history. And it was very gratifying to me, you know, coming into the 21st century, that hard evidence actually began to emerge that something did in fact happen there. And if we go back, one of the things that I'm doing actually right now is I'm taking this traditional template or the traditional pattern of temporal change and correlating it with what hard science is now presenting in terms of, you know, paleoclimatological studies and so on. So what we see is that around 26,000 years ago, according to the most now precise dating based on, you know, radiocarbon dates predominantly, but other types of dating as well, was a major shift in climate that has been called the Late Wisconsin, which was considered to be the final phase of the Great Ice Age in North America. And as far as we can tell from the dating, and there's now dozens and dozens of studies that seem to suggest that right around 26,000 years ago, something quite significant happened to the global climate, and we went from a period of relative warmth, probably not as warm as today, but relative warmth, into this final phase of the Great Ice Age, which interestingly has been dated to about roughly 104,000 years, which is essentially 104,000 divided. You could think of that 104,000 would be four precessional cycles. And then what happened is about 26,000 years ago, there was a sudden cooling of the planet. The glaciers began to expand all over the planet. When we get to the age of Scorpio, which would have been between 17,280 years and 19,440 years, the climate was in the depths of the bitterest glacial cold. The ice sheets were as large as they were going to get. Sea levels had dropped 400 feet. The next 2,160 years went by. This was coming out of the age of Libra. And pretty much right after, early into the age of Virgo, we find that there was another climate shift and it began warming. And for the next 2,160 years, give or take a few decades, there was a gradual warming. The ice sheets began to shrink back. And then suddenly, at about 12,900 years ago, the hammer dropped and there was a major, major catastrophic event that essentially was the death knell for the ice age. Over the next 2,160 years, in the age of Leo, we find that the Earth was rocked by a series of catastrophes. It spelled the end of the Clovis culture in North America. It brought the demise of the great megafauna. Half of the great species of animals around the entire planet disappeared in a geological eye blink. At the end of the age of Leo, about 10,800 years ago, there's that number again, 10,800 before present, we find the present climate regime, what is generally called the Holocene, commences. And by that time, most of the glaciers are gone. Through the age of Cancer, the next 2,160 years, we find the remnants of the great ice sheets are finally disappearing, so that when we get 8,640 years ago, essentially we're right at the very last gasp of the ice age. And then within the next couple of hundred years, something happens. And I think that most likely what happened was there was a large core of ice locked over Hudson Bay. It was suddenly destabilized, and all of this great ponding of meltwater that had formed around the core of the ice sheet was suddenly released into the North Atlantic, so that around 8,300 years ago, we have this major spike of global cooling that only lasted a couple of centuries. Then it was over. Now we're into the age of Gemini. And we find that we're in a very warm period. This was the era of the goddess, when all of these, you know, pregnant, rotund goddess effigies show up in the archaeological record. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever seen the work of Maria Gimbutas, who has done all of this work on the Paleolithic period, saying that essentially it was a time of peace and abundance. And this makes perfect sense, because of the fact that coming out of the Ice Age, the catastrophes that wiped out the great megafauna also decimated human culture. And there's a lot of interesting evidence emerging now that human culture, the human, absolute human population, crashed significantly in the wake of these events and spent basically the next 4,000 years recovering from these catastrophes. Now we get down to the age of Taurus, around 6,000 to 6,480 years ago, and we find another climate shift, which is usually referred to as the neoglaciation, when the climate went through a sudden period over a couple of centuries, it cooled off. And this caused major disruption of human settlements and civilization, because for the previous roughly 4,000 years, in fact, I'm writing a series of articles on this right now that will be posted on the website shortly. During this roughly 4,000 year period, after the Ice Age disappeared, was like I said, the age of the goddess worship. And it was during this period of time that most of the evidence showed that the planet was 1 to 3 degrees warmer than now. There are places where around the world where tree lines were 1,000 to 1,500 feet higher than they are now. The forests were, you know, many hundreds of miles further north than they now grow. And it was a time of pretty much peace and plenty. And then that was terminated by the shift into the neoglaciation, which occurred early in the age of Taurus. Then we get to the cusp of Taurus Aries at 4,320, give or take a few decades, and boom, something happened there that profoundly affected human culture. We find what's known as the Bronze Age collapse. Now, I'm just really skimming through this stuff quick, sure. But the point I'm trying to make here is that it appears that there is a tempo of global change whose timing can be recognized through these very same numbers. And maybe that is why, one of the reasons why it was considered so important to propagate this doctrine of these numbers, because these numbers represented the tempo of these cycles of global change. And I think it's linked with the harmony of the whole solar system and everything. I mean, if we look at the orbital periods of the planets, if you look at the work John Neal and John Martineau, sure, showing these incredible geometric relationships in the spacing and the size of the planets and so on. But it also applies to the tempo of the orbits themselves with a little bit of adjustment. For example, the cycle of Jupiter, the orbital period of Jupiter will become 4,320 days around the sun. With a little bit of adjustment and tweaking, the orbital period of Saturn will become 10,800 solar days around the sun. Hmm. And so the thing that I don't have any hard evidence at all for now, other than an instinctual sense that it's probably correct, is that the timing and tempo of all of these orbital cycles are linked by these numbers, including the tempo of comets and asteroids that have the potential to cross Earth and impact the Earth, causing changes. And it probably extends to the galactic level as well. You know, the work of Paul LaViolette suggests that there's a galactic pulse that somehow, and I'm not studied into his work enough to be able to talk authoritatively about it, other than to say that the basic idea is that he believes there's a galactic pulse that's essentially 26,000 years. And it suggests to me, knowing, as I understand the architecture of the solar system, and here, you know, in a future podcast, we can do some slides and some graphics and stuff that will help people to understand this. But if we go outside the orbit of Neptune, there is basically a vast disk of comets called the Kuiper disk. And that gradually grades into a vast sphere of comets, which is actually part of the architecture of the solar system, but they reach essentially out to, you know, halfway to the nearest stars. And there's this vast sphere of comets surrounding in the very outer reaches of the solar system that are very delicately attached, gravitationally attached to the sun. But because of the fact that there is such a absence of perturbing forces that far out, they remain in this quasi-stable situation unless they're perturbed by something on a much larger level. Now, this outer sphere is called the Oort cloud. So basically what we have is we have the disk of the planets, you know, from Mercury out to Neptune. Mm-hmm. Then beyond Neptune, we have a disk of comets called the Kuiper disk. And then that grades into this spherical distribution of comets called the Oort cloud. Now, it appears that the comets on the Kuiper disk, the inner zone of the Kuiper disk, are going to be affected by gravitational forces of the great outer planets. And what seems to be happening is that as the outer planets conjunct, then, for example, when Uranus and Neptune conjunct, the combined gravitational force of those two in conjunction seems to be enough to destabilize some of the comets that are in the inner zone of the Kuiper disk. Well, once they're destabilized, they're going to either do one of two things. They're going to shift their orbital shell either outward or inward. If they go outward, well, you know, then they just pass into the further outer regions of the disk. If they come inward, they come inside the orbit of Neptune. Now what happens is they become subject to the gravitational perturbations of the planets. And some interesting work has been done showing that the spacing of the planets and the mass of the planets from Venus out to Neptune happens to coincidentally be exactly what we need in order to transfer comets from the outer zone or from the inner zone of the Kuiper disk to the inner solar system. And it has been described by a number of astrophysicists looking at it as sort of a cosmic bucket brigade. And so what happens is if we have the planets and they're in this kind of synchronized orbital frequencies, they conjunct and then they cause the transfer of comets to within the zone of the planets where they can now be captured and either downgraded or upgraded. So in other words, if you can picture this, let's picture Neptune's going around the sun. Okay, now a comet comes within the sphere of influence of Neptune. If the comet is ahead of Neptune, Neptune's gravitational attraction on it is going to cause it to slow down. If it slows down, it moves in closer to the sun. If Neptune is ahead of the comet in its orbit, Neptune's gravitational field accelerates it almost like a slingshot and will throw it further out, where basically it goes out and has no more influence on the events of the inner solar system. But at each stage of this process, you're going to have a number of cometary bodies that are ejected outwards and others that are drawn inwards. Each time some are drawn inwards, they now become subject to the sphere of influence of the next planet in the system. So it would go from Neptune to Uranus coming in, then from there to Saturn, and from there to Jupiter. Once they get to Jupiter, which is the biggest one of the whole, obviously the biggest planetary mass in the solar system, if you can picture the Greek image of Jupiter hurling his thunderbolts, that's exactly what Jupiter does. If you think of the comets as the thunderbolt, Jupiter now hurls them, and it's going to either hurl them further back out or it's going to hurl them in towards the sun. The ones that are hurled in towards the sun now come in to orbits around the sun, periodic orbits around the sun, between the sun and Jupiter, and this is where they become potential Earth crossers. And I think that this is going to be, in the near future, the one big unrecognized factor in global and environmental climatic change is the distribution of cosmic material to the inner solar system. So anyways, what I'm getting at with all of this is that there is likely a tempo that's set up by the orbital frequencies of the planets in the delivery of these comets and cosmic material to the inner solar system, which then would have a correlation with the tempo of global change down here on the Earth. As we move out into the Oort cloud, it appears that there now we're looking at a galactic modulation, events on a galactic level, and here we're probably getting back to some of the work of Paul LaViolette, that, you know, pulsations in the energetic output of the galactic core could cause disruptions in the stability of comets out there in the Oort cloud, in the spherical Oort cloud, and then those comets would then translate or transfer into the Kuiper disk, which is kind of, in a sense, a holding reservoir, if you will, where they will now become subjected to the planetary frequencies. So with all of that is explanation, getting back to your question, I think the issue is that when we look at this, the archaic model of time and this great wheel of time, where all of these synchronous numbers show up, the very numbers that you and I have been in Scott Onstott and John Michel and, you know, other researchers, Martineau and others have been working with, is that these numbers are also the numbers that measure the frequencies of change. So it's, you know, so basically we're looking at like half of a cycle ago, 12,960 years ago, give or take a century or two, something really extraordinary happened to this planet and completely altered its trajectory. We come around one quarter cycle about 6,480 years ago, give or take a few centuries, and we find another change occurring. We come around 2,160 years past that, we find another change occurring. And I've documented some of this going back, that we can find significant global pulses of global change occurring at roughly 52,000 years ago, you know, again at 104,000 years. And in fact, I think in the cosmic patterns, towards the end of it, we show a graphic where I have shown like 20 things going back a couple of hundred thousand years, and the high degree of correlation between the tempo as defined by modern science and the tempo as defined by the ancient traditions. That could be the answer to your question, I think. One of the reasons why this model was so important to preserve, because it actually is the model of cosmic change that is inevitably going to affect us here on the Earth.
This is so interesting, because it's really in accord with when you look at the ancient idea of like the Pythagoreans and the Neopythagoreans of a harmony of the spheres. And so there's, when we look at, you know, cometary impacts and things like that, that this is not necessarily random, that, like, as you were saying, right, there's a tempo to it, and that the ancient people could have understood this temple and therefore understood the season of the macrocosm and understand how that affects us here and these great changes on Earth, which is just so in line with the ancient teachings, which is, to me, is just so absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, because people often ask me, well, you know, you talk about catastrophes and stuff, and then you talk about sacred geometry. I don't say, what's the connection there? Well, maybe in the discussion that we've just had, you know, your listeners might kind of begin to get a sense of what that connection actually is. Yeah. Again, I want to emphasize that sacred geometry is not only the measure of these patterns in space, it's the measure of the patterns in time as well. And when we get into the archaic models of time, we're talking about cyclical time, cyclical changes, periodicities. Mm-hmm. And there's a pretty, you know, pretty rigorous scientific basis to the idea. You know, there's quite a number of scientific studies out there that would suggest that there is a larger global tempo at 26 million years. I don't know if you've seen any of that. I think
sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Uh huh. Yeah. Well, 26 million years. That's 1,000 precessional cycles.
And that's now, our solar system going around the central core of our galaxy. Correct.
Yeah, unless, and I'm sure you're familiar with this idea too, the idea perhaps of a sub-galactic, and I think, and I'm not as familiar with Walter Cruttenden's work as I should be. It's one of those things I'm just trying to find the time to delve into. Oh,
I get you.
doesn't he postulate the existence of a sub-galactic center, orbital center?
Basically, his kind of idea is that, you know, when we look out into the other star systems, we see that they're in groups, they're either binary or whatever. Yeah. So there's a, you know, and so basically the hypothesis is that Sirius is our counterpart, with Sirius B having this massive gravitational pull that would actually between Sirius A and Sirius B be able to have that central gravitational center, and there thus this would actually be the cause of precession, as opposed to the lunar solar theory, which is the idea, you know, the sun and the moon are pulling on the earth, and it's kind of the, you know, the wobble theory. And of course none of this is proven, we don't really know, it's still conjecture, but you know, it's a fascinating theory, and I love his book. So
well, I came across that idea long before I'd ever heard of Walter Cruttenden in back in the 70s when I was studying various spiritual teachers. Have you ever heard of George Gurdjieff?
Oh sure, yeah, of course.
Oh yeah, okay. Well, you know, he talked quite a bit in some of his work, and you know, implicated the idea of a cosmic timetable. One of his students was named Rodney Collin, who wrote a book called The Theory of Celestial Influence, which I'm a little vague on it now because, gosh, I read it, you know, again, late 70s, I think. But one of the ideas he put forward in there was this idea that there was this subgalactic center, and that Sirius was part of it, and he listed a number of other stars, all that are within roughly 10 to 20 light years of the Earth, and all roughly within 10 degrees of being coplanar, and suggested that they were all part of a system, and that Sirius was perhaps the center of that system. My thought was that, you know, the stellar motion of Sirius is about one arc second per year, roughly, which means that relative to the other stars, Sirius is actually moving a little bit each year, one arc second. Well, this is interesting because, and this comes just from the realm of astronomy, right? Mm-hmm. One arc second, that means that if you take the full cycle around, you know, each circle is divided into 360 degrees, each degree into 60 minutes, and each minute into 60 seconds. Well, if you take the full 360 degrees times 60 minutes times 60 seconds, you realize that there are 1,296,000 seconds of arc in every circle. And of course, orbits in the idealized sense are circles. We know they're actually elliptical, but you know, for purposes of discussion, we can think of them in their idealized form as circles. Well, if we think of Sirius as moving one arc second per year, now that just happens to be, you know, one arc second of a circle, right? Mm-hmm. And you know that in very approximate terms, you know, if we look out and we measure the motion of the sun on a daily basis, what we see is that it moves roughly 1 degree per day, right? If it was moving exactly 1 degree per day, it would take 360 days to make one idealized yearly orbit. It actually takes 365, so it takes a little bit longer. But in round numbers, just for discussion, we can say that the sun appears to be transiting against the fixed backdrop of stars one arc degree per day, right? Well, obviously we know that motion of the sun 1 degree per day, the apparent motion, key word there, apparent motion, is not the real motion of the sun. It's our motion relative to the sun, right? Mm-hmm. That it's the earth that's moving around the sun 1 degree per day. Well, the idea, let's translate that idea now to this one arc second of motion of stellar motion that we see Sirius moving. Perhaps that is a measure of our solar system's motion relative to Sirius rather than the other way around, which would imply that the solar system is actually moving around Sirius in an orbit of 1,296,000 years, which coincidentally is exactly the same length of time as the Treta Yuga in the Vedas. So
I think even Walter Crutton had said, I think it was a Vedic temple, and I'm not sure which one, it's escaping me now, but basically that the temple was aligned to Sirius and they actually called it the second sun, which is just fascinating. So
yeah, it is. And Sirius was eminently important to many ancient cultures.
Oh yeah, I mean, we discussed too, is like Pawnee, you know, the Greek, the Egyptians. I mean, it just, any culture you really look at, it's like they point out this star, and of course, it's obviously the brightest star in the sky, that sort of thing. But obviously, it goes beyond just, you know, a bunch of primitive people looking up, being like, "Ooh, bright star." You know, it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and another interesting factor is that the distance of Earth, of our solar system to Sirius, is actually very close to 8.64 light years.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So once again,
that's what's so crazy. It's not just some random number. It's not like 2.857, you know, it's like, no, 8.6. That's, you know, and when you mentioned 26 million years around, you know, going around the central core of our galaxy, the central source, it's those kind of numbers that come up in this investigation that you realize that there is some harmony there. And that's what's so beautiful. We're actually over an hour here. I don't know if you want to keep going for another at least 45 minutes or something. If you got time, that would be great.
I would love to. I'm kind of, you know, I've every once in a while, about every 3 or 4 months, I've had two back injuries in my life, and they flare up about every 3 or 4 months. And last weekend, early last week, it flared up on me. And I've got somebody who's offered to do me a massage for free if I can get over there.
Oh, cool.
So I'm kind of thinking I've been sitting here, you know, I'm sure that when we do, if and when, I hope we do this again, I won't have this issue going on, but it's kind of distracting because I don't know if you've ever had a back injury or not.
Oh, sure. Yeah. It's the worst.
It's the worst. Yeah.
I understand. That's cool. I appreciate your time. So maybe let's just wrap up here and let's talk about, let's talk about your online courses. Let's talk about you're doing a webinar. Can we discuss some of this quick?
Absolutely. Cameron is organizing a webinar, which I think should be in the next month or two. We're going to bring in David Metcalf on that. He and I are going to have a conversation. There will be, you know, a lot of visuals with it. I think it would be better to talk to Cameron about the details, but I think it's going to be quite interesting. And we'll be covering a lot of things that you and I have just talked about. We will have visuals. And of course, if you get it set up in the near future or sometime where, you know, you're able to do the video, we can provide some, you know, as we're talking about this, you know, it'd be nice to flash some visuals up on the screen, you know, the Kuiper disk, the Oort cloud, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
A particular Gothic cathedral. I don't think we have a date set yet, but it will be announced on the Sacred Geometry International website. Whoever's listening, you know, please check out the website, and there's a lot of information, and I'm constantly adding new material to it. I've got a whole series of articles up there. The ones I'm putting up now that have been writing in the last 3 or 4 months are basically dealing with the tempo of cosmic change. I did a whole series on the symbolism of the Holy Grail, which I think you would find extremely interesting if you get a chance. You know, go into the archives on the website and you'll find those articles with a lot of graphics.
Yeah, I read them all. Yeah. And I would highly.
Oh, you did read them all.
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
And you actually recommended them.
Yeah. You know what? Is Cameron, are you there?
I don't know what. He's disappeared.
Oh, okay. I believe, because he sent me the promotion here. I'm just going to mention this here. It says, your webinar is The Quest for the Cosmic Grail, Recovering the Lost History of the World, 2 sessions, one on Sunday, January 4th, and then Sunday, January 11th. And you can check the times on the site. So that's the webinar coming up.
Oh, okay.
So Yeah, but
thank you, Mark. Of course, you know more about it than I do.
No, yeah, he sent it to me. So yeah, and obviously, you know, I direct people to Sacred Geometry International. I promote it all the time. I watch the Cosmic Patterns and Cycles of Catastrophe video, which is fantastic. I'd highly recommend that. And I've also taken the Sacred Geometry online classes, the levels 1 through 3. So people, if you get a chance, go to the site. You can go to Facebook, like them. There's people that post stuff all the time. I post stuff. There's a guy, Joe Dubs, post stuff. You know, we promote Scott Onstad's work and, of course, Randall's work. So please, people, go check that out. And Randall, this is it's been awesome, man. And so please, I would love to do this again. I really appreciate your work. And you know, anytime you need to promote something, just let me know. I'm happy to announce it on my show. So,
well, I sure appreciate it. And I'll just mention, as far as the classes, you know, I got the last couple of months, I've been distracted. I was preparing for that almost 3-week trip with Graham, and then came, you know, I've got a business. So when I came back from that, I had a lot of stuff piled up on my plate, but we are preparing several more classes that should be uploaded soon. You know, I've been covering dynamic symmetry, but what we're going to get into in the next couple of classes is a really detailed, in-depth examination of the golden section and its applications, how to create it, how to draw it, and then how to utilize it. So that should be coming up in the next month. So anybody who has signed up for those classes, we have more material coming on the way.
That's great. Cool. So, all right. Yeah, Randall, let's get better, man. Get that back fixed.
Thanks, man.
And let's do this again for sure, man. We need to do it again. Let's maybe do another podcast and let's do something for the web so we can, you know, you can illustrate some of this stuff for the people so they can really get a visual on it. So
that sounds great, Marty.
All right, man. Keep up the great work.
You too, man.
All right. Thanks.
Look forward to meeting you someday face to face.
Oh, it'll happen.
Sure. Hey, right. Good deal.
All right.
So long, man.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Our outro song is called Quick, Quick, Your Neighbors Hit the Big Time, and is provided by the Portland, Oregon Americana band, The Harm Brothers. These guys are loud, sweaty, high energy, and are the real deal. This is the kind of band that gets in a van, tours their ass off, plays from their heart, and earns every single fan. This track is off the record called Come Morning, and they have 3 records available that you can purchase on iTunes as well as on their site, www.theharmbrothers.com. Go there, check it out, tons of great tunes. Coming up in the next few episodes of the Marty Leeds Math Magical Radio Hour will be author, Freemason, and lecturer Timothy Hogan, host of The Crow House, lecturer and pillar of morality Max Egan, as well as the producer and writer of the documentary The Pyramid Code, Dr. Carmen Bolter. Be sure to stay tuned and always remember, an opinion without pie is just an onion. Thanks.
Been listening to the Marty Leeds Mathemagical Radio Hour. More information about the work of Marty Leeds can be found at MartyLeeds33.com. You can download his full-length studio record, Opus Medico Musica, from iTunes or Amazon.com, and be sure and check out his books, Pi and the English Alphabet, Volume 1 and 2, and The Peacock's Tales, available at MartyLeeds33.com and Amazon. For hours of free video, check out his YouTube channel at MartyLeeds33. More information about SyncBook Press, SyncBook Radio, or SyncBook Events can be found at thesyncbook.com. If you like this podcast, please support it by becoming a donor. You'll find the donation links under each episode on the website and consider setting up a monthly charge. Thanks so much, and though some people think it's a piece of cake, we all know it's easy as pie.